Those copper saucepans are the bane of a plongeur's life. They have to be scoured with sand and bunches of chain, 10 minutes to each one, and then polished on the outside with brasso. Fortunately, the art of making them has been lost, and they are gradually vanishing from French kitchens, though one can still buy them second-hand. When I had begun on the plates, the cook would take me away from the plates to begin skinning onions, and when I had begun on the onions, the patron would arrive and send me out to buy cabbages. When I came back with the cabbages, the patron's wife would tell me to go to some shop half a mile away and buy a pot of rouge. By the time I came back, there would be more vegetables waiting, and the plates were still not done. In this way, our incompetence piled one job on another throughout the day, everything in arrears. Till 10, things went comparatively easily, though we were working fast, and no one lost his temper. The cook would find time to talk about her artistic nature, and say, did I not think Tolstoy was épatant, and sing in a fine soprano voice as she minced beef on the board. But at 10 the waiters began clamouring for their lunch, which they had early, and at 11 the first customers would be arriving. Suddenly everything became hurry and bad temper. There was not the same furious rushing and yelling as at the Hotel X, but an atmosphere of muddle, petty spite and exasperation. Discomfort was at the bottom of it. It was unbearably cramped in the kitchen, and dishes had to be put on the floor, and one had to be thinking constantly about not stepping on them. The cook's vast buttocks banged against me as she moved to and fro. A ceaseless, nagging chorus of orders streamed from her. "Unspeakable idiot! How many times have I told you not to bleed the beetroots? Quick, let me get to the sink. Put those knives away. Get on with the potatoes. What have you done with my strainer? Oh, leave those potatoes alone. Didn't I tell you to skim the bouillon? Take that can of water off the stove. Never mind the washing up. Chop this celery. Not like that, you fool, like this. There, now, look at you, letting those peas boil over. Now get to work and scale those herrings. Look, do you call this plate clean? Wipe it on your apron. Put that salad on the floor, that's right. Put it where I'm bound to step on it. Look out, that pot's boiling over. Get me down that saucepan. No, the other one. Put this on the grill. Throw those potatoes away. Don't waste time. Throw them on the floor. Tread them in. Now throw down some sawdust. This floor's like a skating rink. Look, you fool, that steak's burning. Mon Dieu! Why did they send me an idiot for a plongeur? Who are you talking to? Do you realise that my aunt was a Russian countess? Etc., etc., etc. This went on till 3 o'clock, without much variation, except that about 11 the cook usually had a crise de nerfs and a flood of tears. From 3 to 5 was a fairly slack time for the waiters, but the cook was still busy and I was working my fastest, for there was a pile of dirty plates waiting, and it was a race to get them done, or partly done, before dinner began. The washing up was doubled by the primitive conditions, a cramped draining board, tepid water, sodden cloths, and a sink that got blocked once in an hour. By 5, the cook and I were feeling unsteady on our feet, not having eaten or sat down since 7. We used to collapse, she on the dustbin and I on the floor, drink a bottle of beer, and apologise for some of the things we'd said in the morning. Tea was what kept us going. We took care to have a pot always stewing, and drank pints during the day. At 5:30, the hurrying and quarrelling began again, and now worse than before, because everyone was tired out. The cook had a crise de nerfs at 6, and another at 9. They came on so regularly that one could have told the time by them. She would flop down on the dustbin, begin weeping hysterically, and cry out that never, no, never had she thought to come to such a life as this. Her nerves would not stand it. She had studied music at Vienna. She had a bedridden husband to support, etc., etc. At another time, one would have been sorry for her, but, tired as we all were, her whimpering voice merely infuriated us. Jules used to stand in the doorway and mimic her weeping. The patron's wife nagged, and Boris and Jules quarrelled all day because Jules shirked his work, and Boris, as head waiter, claimed the larger share of the tips. Only the second day after the restaurant opened, they came to blows in the kitchen over a 2-franc tip, and the cook and I had to separate them. The only person who never forgot his manners was the patron. He kept the same hours as the rest of us, but he had no work to do, for it was his wife who really managed things. His sole job, besides ordering the supplies, was to stand in the bar smoking cigarettes and looking gentlemanly, and he did that to perfection. The cook and I generally found time to eat our dinner between 10 and 11 o'clock. At midnight, the cook would steal a packet of food for her husband, stow it under her clothes, and make off, whimpering that these hours would kill her, and she would give notice in the morning. Jules also left at midnight, usually after a dispute with Boris, who had to look after the bar till 2. Between 12 and 12:30, I did what I could to finish the washing up. There was no time to attempt doing the work properly, and I used simply to rub the grease off the plates with table napkins. As for the dirt on the floor, I let it lie, or swept the worst of it out of sight under the stoves. At 12:30, I would put on my coat and hurry out. The patron, bland as ever, would stop me as I went down the alleyway past the bar. "Mais mon cher monsieur, how tired you look. Please do me the favour of accepting this glass of brandy." He would hand me the glass of brandy as courteously as though I had been a Russian duke instead of a plongeur. He treated all of us like this. It was our compensation for working 17 hours a day. As a rule, the last metro was almost empty, a great advantage, for one could sit down and sleep for a quarter of an hour. Generally, I was in bed by 1:30. Sometimes I missed the train and had to sleep on the floor of the restaurant, but it hardly mattered, for I could have slept on cobblestones at that time.
This ends Disc 3. Down and Out in Paris and London. Disc 4.
Chapter 21. This life went on for about a fortnight, with a slight increase of work as more customers came to the restaurant. I could have saved an hour a day by taking a room near the restaurant, but it seemed impossible to find time to change lodgings, or for that matter to get my hair cut, look at a newspaper, or even undress completely. After 10 days I managed to find a free quarter of an hour, and wrote to my friend B in London, asking him if he could get me a job of some sort. Anything, so long as it allowed more than 5 hours sleep. I was simply not equal to going on with a 17-hour day, though there are plenty of people who think nothing of it. When one is overworked, it is a good cure for self-pity to think of the thousands of people in Paris restaurants who work such hours and will go on doing it, not for a few weeks, but for years. There was a girl in a bistro near my hotel who worked from 7 in the morning till midnight for a whole year, only sitting down to her meals. I remember once asking her to come to a dance, and she laughed and said that she hadn't been further than the street corner for several months. She was consumptive, and died about the time I left Paris. After only a week, we were all neurasthenic with fatigue, especially Jules, who skulked persistently. The quarrels, intermittent at first, had now become continuous. For hours one would keep up a drizzle of useless nagging, rising into storms of abuse every few minutes. "Get me down that saucepan, idiot," the cook would cry. She was not tall enough to reach the shelves where the saucepans were kept. "Get it down yourself, you old whore," I'd answer. Such remarks seemed to be generated spontaneously from the air of the kitchen. We quarrelled over things of inconceivable pettiness. The dustbin, for instance, was an unending source of quarrels. Whether it should be put where I wanted it, which was in the cook's way, or where she wanted it, which was between me and the sink. Once she nagged and nagged until, at last, in pure spite, I lifted the dustbin up and put it out in the middle of the floor, where she was bound to trip over it. "Now, you old cow," I said, "move it yourself." Poor old woman. It was too heavy for her to lift. And she sat down, put her head on the table, and burst out crying. And I jeered at her. This is the kind of effect that fatigue has upon one's manners. After a few days, the cook had ceased talking about Tolstoy and her artistic nature, and she and I were not on speaking terms, except for the purposes of work, and Boris and Jules were not on speaking terms, and neither of them was on speaking terms with the cook. Even Boris and I were barely on speaking terms. We had agreed beforehand that the enjolade of working hours did not count between times, but we had called each other things too bad to be forgotten, and besides, there were no between times. Jules grew lazier and lazier, and he stole food constantly, from a sense of duty, he said. He called the rest of us Jean, Blackleg, when we would not join with him in stealing. He had a curious, malignant spirit. He told me, as a matter of pride, that he had sometimes wrung a dirty dishcloth into a customer's soup before taking it in, just to be revenged upon a member of the bourgeoisie. The kitchen grew dirtier, and the rats bolder, though we trapped a few of them. Looking round that filthy room, with raw meat lying among refuse on the floor, and cold, clotted saucepans sprawling everywhere, and the sink blocked and coated with grease, I used to wonder whether there could be a restaurant in the world as bad as ours. But the other three all said that they had been in dirtier places. Jules took a positive pleasure in seeing things dirty. In the afternoon, when he hadn't much to do, he used to stand in the kitchen doorway, jeering at us for working too hard. "Fool! Why do you wash that plate? Wipe it on your trousers. Who cares about the customers? They don't know what's going on. What is restaurant work? You're carving a chicken and it falls on the floor. You apologise, you bow, you go out, and in 5 minutes you come back by another door with the same chicken. That is restaurant work. Etc." And strange to say, in spite of all this filth and incompetence, the Auberge de Jeanne Cottard was actually a success. For the first few days, all our customers were Russians, friends of the patron, and these were followed by Americans and other foreigners, no Frenchmen. Then one night there was tremendous excitement, because our first Frenchman had arrived. For a moment, our quarrels were forgotten, and we all united in the effort to serve a good dinner. Boris tiptoed into the kitchen, jerked his thumb over his shoulder, and whispered conspiratorially, "Shh! Attention! Un Français!" A moment later, the patron's wife came and whispered, "Attention! Un Français! See that he gets a double portion of all vegetables." While the Frenchman ate, the patron's wife stood behind the grill of the kitchen door and watched the expression of his face. Next night, the Frenchman came back with two other Frenchmen. This meant that we were earning a good name. The surest sign of a bad restaurant is to be frequented only by foreigners. Probably part of the reason for our success was that the patron, with the sole gleam of sense he had shown in fitting out the restaurant, had bought very sharp table knives. Sharp knives, of course, are the secret of a successful restaurant. I'm glad that this happened, for it destroyed one of my illusions, namely, the idea that Frenchmen know good food when they see it. Or perhaps we were a fairly good restaurant by Paris standards, in which case the bad ones must be past imagining. In a very few days after I had written to B, he replied to say that there was a job he could get for me. It was to look after a congenital imbecile, which sounded a splendid rest cure after the Auberge de Jeanne Cottard. I pictured myself loafing in the country lanes, knocking thistle heads off with my stick, feeding on roast lamb and treacle tart, and sleeping 10 hours a night in sheets smelling of lavender. B sent me a fiver to pay my passage and get my clothes out of the pawn, and as soon as the money arrived I gave 1 day's notice and left the restaurant. My leaving so suddenly embarrassed the patron, for as usual he was penniless, and he had to pay my wages 30 francs short. However, he stood me a glass of Courvoisier 48 brandy, and I think he felt that this made up the difference. They engaged a Czech, a thoroughly competent plongeur, in my place, and the poor old cook was sacked a few weeks later. Afterwards I heard that, with two first-rate people in the kitchen, the plongeur's work had been cut down to 15 hours a day. Below that no one could have cut it, short of modernising the kitchen. Chapter 22. For what they're worth, I want to give my opinions about the life of a Paris plongeur. When one comes to think of it, it is strange that thousands of people in a great modern city should spend their waking hours swabbing dishes in hot dens underground. The question I'm raising is why this life goes on, what purpose it serves, and who wants it to continue, and why. I'm not taking the merely rebellious, feignant attitude. I'm trying to consider the social significance of a plongeur's life. I think one should start by saying that a plongeur is one of the slaves of the modern world. Not that there's any need to whine over him, for he's better off than many manual workers, but still he is no freer than if he were bought and sold. His work is servile and without art. He is paid just enough to keep him alive. His only holiday is the sack. He is cut off from marriage, or if he marries, his wife must work too. Except by a lucky chance, he has no escape from this life, save into prison. At this moment, there are men with university degrees scrubbing dishes in Paris for 10 or 15 hours a day. One cannot say that it is mere idleness on their part, for an idle man cannot be a plongeur. They have simply been trapped by a routine which makes thought impossible. If Plongeur thought at all, they would long ago have formed a union and gone on strike for better treatment. But they do not think, because they have no leisure for it. Their life has made slaves of them. The question is, why does this slavery continue? People have a way of taking it for granted that all work is done for a sound purpose. They see somebody else doing a disagreeable job and think that they have solved things by saying that the job is necessary. Coal mining, for example, is hard work, but it is necessary. We must have coal. Working in the sewers is unpleasant, but somebody must work in the sewers. And similarly with the plongeur's work. Some people must feed in restaurants, and so other people must swab dishes for 80 hours a week. It is the work of civilization, therefore unquestionable. This point is worth considering. Is a plongeur's work really necessary to civilization? We have a feeling that it must be honest work, because it is hard and disagreeable, and we've made a sort of fetish of manual work. We see a man cutting down a tree, and we make sure that he is filling a social need just because he uses his muscles. It doesn't occur to us that he may only be cutting down a beautiful tree to make room for a hideous statue. I believe it's the same with a plongeur. He earns his bread in the sweat of his brow, but it doesn't follow that he's doing anything useful. He may be only supplying a luxury, which very often is not a luxury. As an example of what I mean by luxuries which are not luxuries, take an extreme case, such as one hardly sees in Europe. Take an Indian rickshaw puller, or a gharry pony. In any far eastern town there are rickshaw pullers by the hundred, black wretches weighing 8 stone, clad in loincloths. Some of them are diseased, some of them are 50 years old. For miles on end they trot in the sun or rain, head down, dragging at the shafts, with the sweat dripping from their grey moustaches. When they go too slowly, the passenger calls them by inchut. They earn 30 or 40 rupees a month, and cough their lungs out after a few years. The gharry ponies are gaunt, vicious things, that have been sold cheap as having a few years' work left in them. Their master looks on the whip as a substitute for food. Their work expresses itself in a sort of equation. Whip plus food equals energy. Generally, it's about 60% whip and 40% food. Sometimes their necks are encircled by one vast sore, so that they drag all day on raw flesh. It is still possible to make them work, however. It's just a question of thrashing them so hard that the pain behind outweighs the pain in front. After a few years, even the whip loses its virtue, and the pony goes to the knacker. These are instances of unnecessary work, for there is no real need for gharries and rickshaws. They only exist because Orientals consider it vulgar to walk. They are luxuries, and as anyone who has ridden in them knows, very poor luxuries. They afford a small amount of convenience, which cannot possibly balance the suffering of the men and animals. Similarly with the plongeur. He's a king compared with a rickshaw puller or a gharry pony, but his case is analogous. He is the slave of an hotel or a restaurant, and his slavery is more or less useless. For after all, where is the real need of big hotels and smart restaurants? They're supposed to provide luxury, but in reality they provide only a cheap, shoddy imitation of it. Nearly everyone hates hotels. Some restaurants are better than others, but it's impossible to get as good a meal in a restaurant as one can get for the same expense in a private house. No doubt hotels and restaurants must exist, but there's no need that they should enslave hundreds of people. What makes the work in them is not the essentials. It is the shams that are supposed to represent luxury. Smartness, as it's called, means, in effect, merely that the staff work more and the customers pay more. No one benefits except the proprietor, who will presently buy himself a striped villa at Deauville. Essentially, a smart hotel is a place where 100 people toil like devils in order that 200 may pay through the nose for things they don't really want. If the nonsense were cut out of hotels and restaurants, and the work done with simple efficiency, plongeur might work 6 or 8 hours a day instead of 10 or 15. Suppose it's granted that a plongeur's work is more or less useless, then the question follows, Why does anyone want him to go on working? I'm trying to go beyond the immediate economic cause and to consider what pleasure it can give anyone to think of men swabbing dishes for life. For there's no doubt that people, comfortably situated people, do find a pleasure in such thoughts. A slave, Marcus Cato said, should be working when he's not sleeping. It doesn't matter whether his work is needed or not, he must work because work in itself is good. For slaves, at least. This sentiment still survives, and it has piled up mountains of useless drudgery. I believe that this instinct to perpetuate useless work is, at bottom, simply fear of the mob. The mob, the thought runs, are such low animals that they would be dangerous if they had leisure. It is safer to keep them too busy to think. A rich man who happens to be intellectually honest, if he's questioned about the improvement of working conditions, usually says something like this. We know that poverty is unpleasant. In fact, since it is so remote, we rather enjoy harrowing ourselves with the thought of its unpleasantness. But don't expect us to do anything about it. We're sorry for you lower classes, just as we're sorry for a cat with the mange. But we'll fight like devils against any improvement of your condition. We feel that you are much safer as you are. The present state of affairs suits us, and we are not going to take the risk of setting you free, even by an extra hour a day. So, dear brothers, since evidently you must sweat to pay for our trips to Italy, sweat, and be damned to you. This is particularly the attitude of intelligent, cultivated people, one who can read the substance of it in 100 essays. Very few cultivated people have less than, say, £400 a year, and naturally they side with the rich because they imagine that any liberty conceded to the poor is a threat to their own liberty. Foreseeing some dismal Marxian utopia as the alternative, the educated man prefers to keep things as they are. Possibly he doesn't like his fellow rich very much, but he supposes that even the vulgarest of them are less inimical to his pleasures, more his kind of people than the poor, and that he'd better stand by them. It is this fear of a supposedly dangerous mob that makes nearly all intelligent people conservative in their opinions. Fear of the mob is a superstitious fear. It is based on the idea that there is some mysterious, fundamental difference between rich and poor, as though they were two different races, like Negroes and white men. But in reality, there is no such difference. The mass of the rich and the poor are differentiated by their incomes and nothing else. And the average millionaire is only the average dishwasher dressed in a new suit. Change places, and handy-dandy, which is the justice, which is the thief? Everyone who is mixed on equal terms with the poor knows this quite well. But the trouble is that intelligent, cultivated people, the very people who might be expected to have liberal opinions, never do mix with the poor. For what do the majority of educated people know about poverty? In my copy of Villon's poems, the editor has actually thought it necessary to explain the line, "Ne pas ne voyons qu'au fenestre," by a footnote. So remote is even hunger from the educated man's experience. From this ignorance, the superstitious fear of the mob results quite naturally. The educated man pictures a horde of sub-men, wanting only a day's liberty to loot his house, burn his books, and set him to work minding a machine or sweeping out a lavatory. Anything, he thinks, any injustice sooner than let that mob loose. He doesn't see that since there is no difference between the mass of rich and poor, there is no question of setting the mob loose. The mob is in fact loose now, and, in the shape of rich men, is using its power to set up enormous treadmills of boredom, such as smart hotels. To sum up, a plongeur is a slave, and a wasted slave, doing stupid and largely unnecessary work. He is kept at work ultimately because of a vague feeling that he would be dangerous if he had leisure. An educated people who should be on his side acquiesce in the process because they know nothing about him and consequently are afraid of him. I say this of the plongeur because it is his case I've been considering. It would apply equally to numberless other types of worker. These are only my own ideas about the basic facts of a plongeur's life, made without reference to immediate economic questions, and no doubt largely platitudes. I present them as a sample of the thoughts that are put into one's head by working in an hotel. Chapter 23. As soon as I left the Auberge de Jean Cottard, I went to bed and slept the clock round all but 1 hour. Then I washed my teeth for the first time in a fortnight, bathed and had my hair cut, and got my clothes out of pawn. I had 2 glorious days of loafing. I even went in my best suit to the Auberge, leant against the bar, and spent 5 francs on a bottle of English beer. It's a curious sensation being a customer where you've been a slave's slave. Boris was sorry that I had left the restaurant, just at the moment when we were lancers and there was a chance of making money. I've heard from him since, and he tells me that he's making 100 francs a day and has set up a girl who is très sérieuse and never smells of garlic. I spent a day wandering about our quarter, saying goodbye to everyone. It was on this day that Charlie told me about the death of old Roucolle, the miser, who had once lived in the quarter. Very likely Charlie was lying as usual, but it was a good story. Roucolle died, aged 74, a year or two before I went to Paris. But the people in the quarter still talked of him while I was there. He never equaled Daniel Dancer or anyone of that kind, but he was an interesting character. He went to Les Halles every morning to pick up damaged vegetables, and ate cat's meat, and wore newspaper instead of underclothes, and used the wainscoting of his room for firewood, and made himself a pair of trousers out of a sack. All this with 500,000 francs invested. I should very much like to have known him. Like many misers, Roucolle came to a bad end through putting his money into a wildcat scheme. One day a Jew appeared in the quarter, an alert, businesslike young chap, who had a first-rate plan for smuggling cocaine into England. It's easy enough, of course, to buy cocaine in Paris, and the smuggling would be quite simple in itself. Only there is always some spy who betrays the plan to the customs or the police. It is said that this is often done by the very people who sell the cocaine, because the smuggling trade is in the hands of a large combine who do not want competition. The Jew, however, swore that there was no danger. He knew a way of getting cocaine direct from Vienna, not through the usual channels, and there would be no blackmail to pay. He had got in touch with Roucolle through a young Pole, a student at the Sorbonne, who was going to put 4,000 francs into the scheme if Roucolle would put 6,000. For this, they could buy 10 pounds of cocaine, which would be worth a small fortune in England. The Pole and the Jew had a tremendous struggle to get the money from between old Roucolle's claws. 6,000 francs was not much. He had more than that sewn into the mattress in his room, but it was agony for him to part with a sou. The Pole and the Jew were at him for weeks on end, explaining, bullying, coaxing, arguing, going down on their knees and imploring him to produce the money. The old man was half frantic between greed and fear. His bowels yearned at the thought of getting, perhaps, 50,000 francs profit, and yet he could not bring himself to risk the money. He used to sit in a corner, with his head in his hands, groaning, and sometimes yelling out in agony, and often he would kneel down, he was very pious, and pray for strength, but still he couldn't do it. But at last, more from exhaustion than anything else, he gave in quite suddenly. He slit open the mattress where his money was concealed, and handed over 6,000 francs to the Jew. The Jew delivered the cocaine the same day and promptly vanished. And meanwhile, as was not surprising after the fuss Roucolle had made, the affair had been noised all over the quarter. The very next morning, the hotel was raided and searched by the police. Roucolle and the Pole were in agonies. The police were downstairs, working their way up and searching every room in turn, and there was the great packet of cocaine on the table, with no place to hide it, and no chance of escaping down the stairs. The Pole was for throwing the stuff out of the window, but Roucolle wouldn't hear of it. Charlie told me that he had been present at the scene. He said that when they tried to take the packet from Roucolle, he clasped it to his breast and struggled like a madman. Although he was 74 years old, he was wild with fright, but he would go to prison rather than throw his money away. At last, when the police were searching only one floor below, somebody had an idea. A man on Roucolle's floor had 12 tins of face powder, which he was selling on commission. It was suggested that the cocaine could be put into the tins and passed off as face powder. The powder was hastily thrown out of the window, and the cocaine substituted, and the tins were put openly on Roucol's table, as though there were nothing to conceal. A few minutes later, the police came to search Roucol's room. They tapped the walls and looked up the chimney and turned out the drawers and examined the floorboards, and then, just as they were about to give it up, having found nothing, the inspector noticed the tins on the table. "Tiens," he said, "have a look at those tins. I hadn't noticed them. What's in them, eh?" "Face powder," said the Pole, as calmly as he could manage. But at the same instant, Roucol let out a loud groaning noise from alarm, and the police became suspicious immediately. They opened one of the tins and tipped out the contents, and after smelling it, the inspector said that he believed it was cocaine. Roucol and the Pole began swearing on the names of the saints that it was only face powder, but it was no use. The more they protested, the more suspicious the police became. The two men were arrested and led off to the police station, followed by half the quarter. At the station, Roucol and the Pole were interrogated by the commissaire, while a tin of the cocaine was sent away to be analysed. Charlie said that the scene Roucol made was beyond description. He wept, prayed, made contradictory statements, and denounced the Pole all at once, so loud that he could be heard half a street away. The policeman almost burst with laughing at him. After an hour, a policeman came back with a tin of cocaine and a note from the analyst. He was laughing. "This is not cocaine, monsieur," he said. "What? Not cocaine?" said the commissaire. "Mais alors, what is it then?" "It is face powder." Roucol and the Pole were released at once, entirely exonerated but very angry. The Jew had double-crossed them. Afterwards, when the excitement was over, it turned out that he had played the same trick on two other people in the quarter. The Pole was glad enough to escape, even though he'd lost his 4,000 francs. But poor old Roucol was utterly broken down. He took to his bed at once, and all that day and half the night they could hear him thrashing about, mumbling, and sometimes yelling out at the top of his voice, 6,000 francs, nom de Jésus Christ! 6,000 francs! 3 days later, he had some kind of stroke, and in a fortnight he was dead. Of a broken heart, Charlie said. Chapter 24. I travelled to England, third class, via Dunkirk and Tilbury, which is the cheapest and not the worst way of crossing the Channel. You had to pay extra for a cabin, so I slept in the saloon, together with most of the third-class passengers. I find this entry in my diary for that day. Sleeping in the saloon, 27 men, 16 women. Of the women, not a single one has washed her face this morning. The men mostly went to the bathroom. The women merely produced vanity cases and covered the dirt with powder. Question. A secondary sexual difference? On the journey, I fell in with a couple of Romanians, mere children, who were going to England on their honeymoon trip. They asked innumerable questions about England, and I told them some startling lies. I was so pleased to be getting home after being hard up for months in a foreign city that England seemed to me a sort of paradise. There are indeed many things in England that make you glad to get home. Bathrooms, armchairs, mint sauce, new potatoes properly cooked, brown bread, marmalade, beer made with veritable hops. They're all splendid if you can pay for them. England is a very good country when you're not poor. And, of course, with a tame imbecile to look after, I was not going to be poor. The thought of not being poor made me very patriotic. The more questions the Romanians asked, the more I praised England. The climate, the scenery, the art, the literature, the laws, everything in England was perfect. Was the architecture in England good? The Romanians asked. Splendid, I said. And you should just see the London statues. Paris is vulgar, half grandiosity and half slums, but London! Then the boat drew alongside Tilbury Pier. The first building we saw on the waterside was one of those huge hotels, all stucco and pinnacles, which stare from the English coast like idiots staring over an asylum wall. I saw the Romanians, too polite to say anything, cocking their eyes at the hotel. Built by French architects, I assured them. And even later, when the train was crawling into London through the eastern slums, I still kept it up about the beauties of English architecture. Nothing seemed too good to say about England, now that I was coming home and was not hard up any more. I went to B's office, and his first words knocked everything to ruins. "I'm sorry," he said. "Your employees have gone abroad, patient and all. However, they'll be back in a month. I suppose you can hang on till then." I was outside in the street before it even occurred to me to borrow some more money. There was a month to wait, and I had exactly 19 and sixpence in hand. The news had taken my breath away. For a long time I couldn't make up my mind what to do. I loafed the day in the streets, and at night, not having the slightest notion of how to get a cheap bed in London, I went to a family hotel, where the charge was 7 and 6 pence. After paying the bill, I had 10 and 2 pence in hand. By the morning I had made my plans. Sooner or later I should have to go to B for more money, but it seemed hardly decent to do so yet, and in the meantime I must exist in some hole-and-corner way. Past experience set me against pawning my best suit. I would leave all my things at the station cloakroom, except my second best suit, which I could exchange for some cheap clothes and perhaps a pound. If I was going to live a month on 30 shillings, I must have bad clothes. Indeed, the worse the better. Whether 30 shillings could be made to last a month, I had no idea, not knowing London as I knew Paris. Perhaps I could beg or sell bootlaces, and I remembered articles I'd read in the Sunday papers about beggars who have £2,000 sewn into their trousers. It was, at any rate, notoriously impossible to starve in London, so there was nothing to be anxious about. To sell my clothes, I went down into Lambeth, where the people are poor, and there are a lot of rag shops. At the first shop I tried, the proprietor was polite, but unhelpful. At the second, he was rude. At the third, he was stone deaf, or pretended to be so. The fourth shopman was a large, blonde young man, very pink all over, like a slice of ham. He looked at the clothes I was wearing and felt them disparagingly between thumb and finger. "Poor stuff," he said. "Very poor stuff, that is." It was quite a good suit. "What do you want for them?" I explained that I wanted some older clothes and as much money as he could spare. He thought for a moment, then collected some dirty-looking rags and threw them onto the counter. "What about the money?" I said, hoping for a pound. He pursed his lips, then produced a shilling, and laid it beside the clothes. I didn't argue. I was going to argue, but as I opened my mouth, he reached out as though to take up the shilling again. I saw that I was helpless. He let me change in a small room behind the shop. The clothes were a coat, once dark brown, a pair of black dungaree trousers, a scarf and a cloth cap. I had kept my own shirt, socks and boots, and I had a comb and razor in my pocket. It gives one a very strange feeling to be wearing such clothes. I had worn bad enough things before, but nothing at all like these. They were not merely dirty and shapeless. They had, how is one to express it, a gracelessness, a patina of antique filth, quite different from mere shabbiness. They were the sort of clothes you see on a bootlace seller or a tramp. An hour later, in Lambeth, I saw a hangdog man, obviously a tramp, coming towards me. And when I looked again, it was myself, reflected in a shop window. The dirt was plastering my face already. Dirt is a great respecter of persons. It lets you alone when you're well-dressed. But as soon as your collar's gone, it flies towards you from all directions. I stayed in the streets till late at night, keeping on the move all the time. Dressed as I was half afraid that the police might arrest me as a vagabond, and I dared not speak to anyone, imagining that they must notice a disparity between my accent and my clothes. Later I discovered that this never happened. My new clothes had put me instantly into a new world. Everyone's demeanour seemed to have changed abruptly. I helped a hawker pick up a barrow that he'd upset. "Thanks, mate," he said with a grin. No one had called me mate before in my life. It was the clothes that had done it. For the first time I noticed, too, how the attitude of women varies with a man's clothes. When a badly dressed man passes them, they shudder away from him with a quite frank movement of disgust, as though he were a dead cat. Clothes are powerful things. Dressed in a tramp's clothes, it is very difficult, at any rate for the first day, not to feel that you are genuinely degraded. You might feel the same shame, irrational but very real, your first night in prison. At about 11, I began looking for a bed. I had read about doss houses. They are never called doss houses, by the way. And I supposed that one could get a bed for fourpence or thereabouts. Seeing a man, a navvy or something of the kind, standing on the curb in the Waterloo Road, I stopped and questioned him. I said that I was stony broke and wanted the cheapest bed I could get.